hunger strike is a protest method. Those who go on a hunger strike refuse food or drink. People use hunger strikes when they have no other way of protesting. Prisoners usually do this to protest their detention conditions, call for a change in a policy, or bring attention to a specific matter. By drawing international attention to the plight of prisoners, they aim to put pressure on their jailers and spur a change in policy. That's what Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have been doing. For decades, thousands of Palestinian inmates have gone under hunger strikes to protest their situation. The administrative detention and the fact that the Israeli regime has no right to hold them without any specific reason.
As for Hiba, she was arrested on August 15th at the Kerama border crossing where she was on her way from Jordan to the West Bank. She was held and interrogated at an intelligence center, being denied any liars. The commission's liar visited her 2 days ago, and in her report, she said Hiba's lost around 10 kilograms. She's been isolated, abused, assaulted, and held in brutal conditions. She informed the liar she won't end the hunger strike as long as she's held under administrative detention.
Israeli occupation is primarily responsible for the life of Maher al-Akhras because after more than 70 days of a hunger strike, he suffered serious weight loss and he repeatedly loses consciousness. His heart could suddenly stop. Today he's in a serious health condition. This requires immediate intervention from all sides to reach a solution to save his life.
Under international law, Israel is responsible for the well-being of all persons in its custody. So hunger strikes can be used to pressure the occupying regime. Earlier this month, a mass hunger strike was staged across Israeli jails. Up to 400 Palestinian inmates went on a hunger strike. Just in September, another 1,400 Palestinian prisoners launched a hunger strike. Both hunger strikes were in reaction to the punitive measures imposed on Palestinian inmates following the escape of six Palestinians from Gilbo prison last month. It all started on September 6th when Israeli jail authorities realized that six inmates had escaped the maximum security jail through a tunnel. The jailbreak made a mockery of Israeli authorities. Although all six escapees were captured, the fact that they carried out such an operation right under the nose of prison guards made it quite embarrassing. So in response, the Israeli prison service cracked down particularly hard on prisoners belonging to the Islamic Jihad, to which five of the escapees belong. The Israelis transferred several prisoners belonging to the Islamic Jihad to solitary confinement, and leaders of the movement were transferred to interrogation cells. The conditions the prisoners were living under were so harsh, they decided to stage a hunger strike. In a statement, the prisoners said the strike is a rebellion and rejection of prison administration laws. Since 1968, Palestinians have been launching mass and individual hunger strikes after Israel occupied the remaining Palestinian territories of the West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip. The first strike was on February 18, 1969, in Ramleh prison. The prisoners protested meager portions and poor quality food, as well as the policy of banning writing stationery and being forced to address their jailers as sir. The strike ended when prison authorities put the prisoners in solitary confinement. In July 1970, Abdul Ghader Abu Al-Fahm became the first Palestinian prisoner to die during a hunger strike. Al-Fahm died because of force feeding by Israeli prison authorities, who inserted a nasal feeding tube into his lungs instead of his stomach. Israel constantly uses this method of force feeding prisoners on hunger strike. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has called on Israel to ensure that prisoners on hunger strike are not subjected to force feeding or other medical treatment against their will, as it could amount to torture. The world body also said the practice under no circumstances will comply with human rights standards. A hunger strike in September 1984 is considered a turning point in the history of hunger strikes. 800 prisoners reportedly joined the strike for better conditions in the Nablus prison. Prisoners were crammed into overcrowded cells, suffering from a lack of ventilation and no reading material. The strike brought about many changes, such as bringing in a radio, TV, clothes, and better quality food. In 1992, one of the most successful hunger strikes across Israeli jails occurred. 7,000 prisoners joined the movement. The strike resulted in major achievements, such as shutting down the prison's isolation section, stopping strip searches, increasing family visitation time, and allowing cooking slates in the cells. Mikhdad Qawasme is the latest individual who has staged a hunger strike against his administrative detention. The last time the 24-year-old was on the news, he was in an intensive care unit after 91 days of strikes. It's often said that hunger strikes are a non-violent form of protest, but by refusing food and drink, protesters put their lives in danger. They risk permanent damage to their health and eventually death. Even after a protester decided to end a hunger strike, there is the potential risk of refeeding syndrome. This syndrome occurs because of the shifts in fluids and electrolytes, meaning that giving too much food or fluids too quickly may be dangerous and potentially fatal. It may include liver dysfunction, heart arrhythmia, and pulmonary, neurological, or other symptoms. There are cases in which hunger strikes can amount to torture as well. There are currently 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, including 35 women and 200 children. All these hunger strikes are just last desperate calls for help from Palestinian prisoners. Will the international community finally do something serious for them?
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, summoned Muslims to think things over Imam al-Baghir, peace be upon him, said, "Through thinking things over, the fruitful opinion is concluded." This word is among the wonderful maxims. Man can come to a correct, genuine opinion through considering things carefully. He can conclude scientific facts and inventions through contemplating things. It is impossible for him to come to that without contemplation.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has these beautiful conversations with his friends and his relatives, his family and his companions, and the people in general, where he talks about certain Islamic ethics, these Islamic codes of conduct, which are prescribed by Allah, the creator of the universes, in order for humanity to attain ultimate perfection. Now, these conversations that Imam al-Baqir has, if we pay close attention to them and apply them in our lives, we will really find that our individual life, our communal life, our societal life, and our nations and countries and the world in general will be a much, much better place to live in. So when Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is asked about what are the best of deeds, Imam al-Baqir replies in this conversation, in this dialogue, that the best of deeds are three. Now, one of these three deeds, Imam al-Baqir says, is giving the friend money. It's such a simple thing here, but there's a couple of prerequisites that we have. Of course, first of all, you need to have the money. If you don't have money, if you don't have wealth, how are you going to give it to somebody else? So first and foremost, we should have wealth. Now, why do we have wealth? We have wealth, or we acquire wealth, we gain wealth, first and foremost in halal means, that is recommended and permissible means, for what? In order to spend that wealth on the path and in the way of Allah. So we have to have wealth, then we want to give this wealth to a friend. Remember, this has to be a friend, not a foe, not an enemy of Islam, not an enemy of the religion, not an enemy of God. We can't give our wealth to these people or these entities. We cannot give our wealth to the enemies of God and the enemies of religion and the enemies of the Muslims and the enemies of Islam and the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt and the enemies of the Quran. We should give our wealth for the sake of God to our friends, meaning to the Muslim brothers and sisters, to the weak and oppressed across the world. This is who we should give our money to. And so, as Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says so eloquently, one of the best actions which are loved by Allah, is giving the friend money. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
What I'd like to discuss in our remembrance of Imam al-Baqir salamullahi alayhi briefly is a matter that I think applies to us today. Imam al-Baqir has been given that title, otherwise his name is Muhammad ibn Ali. Salamullahi alayhima. His name is Muhammad. His nickname, his laqab, as it is referred to, or the word used in Arabic, which means that this is a name given to him. The meaning of the word is someone who splits, the one who splits the seed of the knowledge after the Prophet, or the seed of the knowledge of prophets. The reason why Imam al-Baqir is known for that is the knowledge of the Holy Prophet, for various reasons, for now close to a century, has been kept from the people. The people were told at one point that in order to make sure the Quran is preserved, we must burn all the writings of the sayings of the Prophet. And anyone who kept any writing of the sayings of the Prophet was forced to burn it, or get rid of it, or destroy it one way or another. The narration of hadith was restricted to certain individuals who did not pass on the knowledge of the Prophet, the sunnah of the Prophet as it was. Fabrications began to emerge. Those who knew the knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt, Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayhi, was put in a position not to be speaking publicly and to share that knowledge. Imam al-Mujtaba similarly. Imam al-Husayn similarly. In different ways, the conditions that they were in, there wasn't much that could be said. The Imams did share their knowledge in different ways, of course, that when we discuss those Imams and their struggle and their plans and how they conducted themselves as the Imams of the Ummah during their time. And Imam Zain al-Abidin was in a very critical time as well. But the reason why Imam al-Baqir is given that title is because on a more public scale, the Imam is now sharing the knowledge of the Prophet and the Prophets on a more public scale.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
About you, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the limelight.
The new report has a stark scientific message for climate change negotiators at COP26, said the head of the World Meteorological Organization. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanes, journalist. This article is published under the heading Humanity Way Off Track. WMO says atmospheric carbon at level unseen in 3 million years. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Carbon dioxide concentrations reached a new record high in 2020, with comparable levels not seen for roughly 3 million years, the United Nations Weather Agency said recently. The findings came in the latest edition of the World Meteorological Organization's Greenhouse Gas Bulletin, released a week before COP26, the UN Climate Summit, kicks off in Glasgow. According to WMO Secretary General Professor Petteri Tallas, the report holds a stark scientific message for climate change negotiators headed to the summit. The bulletin said globally average levels of CO2 as well as two other potent greenhouse gases, methane and nitrous oxide, were all up from the previous year. CO2 reached 413.2 parts per million ppm in 2020, 149% of the pre-industrial level. The increase from 2019 levels came despite pandemic-triggered lockdowns, triggering an approximately 5.6% drop in fossil fuel CO2. Methane stood at 262% and nitrous oxide at 123% of pre-industrial levels, the report said. At the current rate of increase in greenhouse gas concentrations, we will see a temperature increase by the end of this century far in excess of the Paris Agreement targets of 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, he said in a statement warning we are way off track. The amount of CO2 in the atmosphere breached the milestone of 400 parts per million in 2015, and just 5 years later, it exceeded 413 ppm, Tallas added. This is more than just a chemical formula and figures on a graph. It has major negative repercussions for our daily lives and well-being, for the state of our planet, and for the future of our children and grandchildren, he added. Tallas said carbon dioxide remains in the atmosphere for centuries and in the ocean for even longer. Last time the Earth experienced a comparable concentration of CO2 was 3 to 5 million years ago, when the temperature was 2 to 3 degrees Celsius warmer and sea level was 10 to 20 meters higher than now. The report also warned that land and ocean's ability to continue serving as carbon sinks, sucking up about half of CO2 emissions, could be negatively affected by climate crisis-related changes such as wildfires. Urging countries to turn commitment into action, Tallas said, there is no time to lose. Dave Rhee, a professor at the University of Edinburgh and director of the Edinburgh Climate Change Institute, also tied the bulletin's findings to the upcoming UN climate summit. He said in the statement, "The true success or failure of COP26 will be written in our skies in the form of greenhouse gas concentrations." This is a new report from WMO, which provides a brutally frank assessment of what's been written there to date. He said, "So far, it's an epic fail. Will this 26 COP find success where the previous 25 have fallen short? Our atmosphere will bear witness."
But beside being a work regarding glossaries of the Holy Quran, the main important point regarding At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim is that author has some, you know, basic rules in his mind, and he is trying to use these rules to deliver a book to the people, to the researchers, in a way that they may get use from this book and to find a new outstanding meaning of the Holy Quran.
And why you are enjoying reading that book? Because it gives you this sense of freedom that you also, as a reader, you have this sense of ijtihad and expertise to go through different books, make a comparison, and then come to your point.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. The teacher is about the lives and works of the most outstanding Shiite scholars, thinkers, jurists, and philosophers all across the world of Islam. And with me in the studio for today's discussion are Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziani. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Today we want to talk about an outstanding figure, a researcher in the field of Quranic studies and the author of At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Quran al-Karim. He is no one but Mirza Hasan Mustafavi, mainly known as Allama Mustafavi, one of the outstanding figures in the 15th century Hijra, one of the students of Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani, Hujjat Kukhamari, and Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Isfahani. He is regarded among the mufassirs, the exegetes, and also the fuqaha, the faqihs, or the jurists, the Shia ones, a person who knew four languages, you know, the Persian, the Arabic, you know, Turkish, French, and Hebrew, and this made him an exception in the field of Islamic studies. Sheikh Ziani, let's start with you, brother. Give us a background about Mirza Hasan Mustafavi, about his early life, especially.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Allama Mustafavi was born in Tabriz in the year 1334 in lunar calendar. And he was born in a family that his father was amongst scholars. Of course, his father was not wearing turban or this, you know, special uniform, but he was a person who was knowledgeable in religious studies and was helpful to people also in the city of Tabriz.
That's right.
He studied during his childhood in Tabriz, and after a while he moved to Qom and continued his studies in the city of Qom, that it was about 7 years. And after that he moved to Al-Najaf al-Ashraf to continue his studies. And when he was about 25, he left Al-Najaf al-Ashraf and he came to Qom, and then he moved to Tehran, and he was living in Tehran up to the end of his life.
That's right.
And Allama Mustafavi was a prominent scholar in different fields.
That's right.
Especially regarding the studies in Quranic teachings.
Yes.
And, you know, he had the degree of ijtihad.
Oh.
And he had this permission from late Marhum Asad Abul Hasan Isfahani, Rahmatullah Alayh, a great marja of Shia. And he also achieved the PhD degree from Tabriz University. And, you know, so he is a bipolar scholar.
Very good.
And he had both degrees from Islamic seminaries and also the university.
So academically speaking, he got his PhD from the university. Very good. What was the main field of study in at the university?
Theology.
Oh, Shiite theology, yes, Islamic Shia. Theology. Okay, very good. So usually, you know, these faculties of the universities were called as ma'qul and mangul on that time, okay? Nowadays, yeah. Somehow they call it elohiyat or ma'arif, okay? But ma'qul and mangul, it means belonging to both the rational studies and the narrative studies, you know, the Islamic ones. So,
and it is notable also that he achieved bachelor degree and then PhD degree. You know, he studied the every level of the university, yes, in the right. University of
Sorry for, yeah, the graduate and then postgraduate, yes. Ones. That's right. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's get to you, brother. What information can you give us about the scholarly life of Allama Mustafavi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Allama Mustafavi truly was a genius, yes. As our brother mentioned. He was born to a house of knowledge. His father was considered as an exegete and mufassirin, mm-hmm. of his city. And unfortunately, he lost his father when he was 2 years old. And as you also mentioned, that another name, which is Allama, is known for is Mirza Hassan.
That's right.
Mustafavi. Mirza meaning, actually, this is a title,
okay,
given to person who are born from a mother which is Sayyid or Sayyida.
Sayyida.
Yes.
So Mirza is a title given to those who are born, but if the father is not Sayyid, but the mother,
yes,
is Sayyida.
If the father is Sayyid, it is called Sayyid, which it is,
yes.
Common,
okay.
Among us. Everybody,
yes.
Knows about that.
Yes.
But specifically in our Iranian culture, when we call somebody as Mirza, this is a title given to people who are born to a Sayyida mother.
Very good.
And also whose grandmother, Fatima, was really admirable and respectful in her time in the city of Tabriz.
That's right.
This is really important to know about Allama Sayyid Hassan al-Mustafavi, that during his time, he met two great marja. Mm-hmm. Among the scholars that he met, many of them, they were mujtahid.
That's right.
Like Allama Naini,
yes.
Who is the teacher of Sayyid al-Khuy.
That's right.
But two great marja, one which is considered as the great maraja of Iraq, Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani.
That's right.
Our dear brother mentioned Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani at that time was the leader of the Hawzat al-Iraq.
Okay.
So
the Za'im, they,
yes,
say.
Yes, what,
right.
Is called in Arabic language as a Za'im.
That's right.
So he met him, and this is also recorded in the history that he got permission of ijtihad from this great marja, Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani.
That's right.
And also he met the great marja of Iran at that time, which is Sayyid al-Burujerdi.
That's right.
When Sayyid al-Burujerdi, because of some certain operation, was hospitalized in a hospital in Shahr-e-Ray.
That's right.
Allama Mustafavi met him. And to know about the degree of his knowledge, this is very important to know that Sayyid al-Burujerdi invited him to come and stay in Qom and take a seat for teaching,
right.
And distributing knowledge among the tullab. But due to some certain or private reasons, he didn't accept, and he stayed in Tehran, as our brother mentioned, up until his last day of his life.
That's all right. Hujjat Kukamari, Ayatollah Hujjat Kukamari.
Yes, this is the teacher,
yes.
Who actually Allama Hassan al-Mustafavi was participating in his class in Qom.
Mm-hmm.
Before he moved to Najaf, he came to Qom. He stayed in Qom for 7 years.
That's right.
And he was benefiting from the Asatid, among which Hujjat Kukamari also is mentioned.
I've heard that Hujjatiyah school is named after this professor, is it?
Yes,
Kukamari,
this is one of the
right.
Old seminary schools,
yeah.
Which is
and it still is active, you know.
Yes, still.
So many students and tullabs are getting
foreign students mainly
affordances.
Are going there,
that's
and
right.
Get their education.
Very great. So one of the interesting points about the scholarly life of Allama Mustafavi is his mastery over different languages. You know, Sheikh Ziyainiyah, Turkish, you know, which seems to be his mother language, and Arabic, which is Islamic language. But French and Hebrew are really strange for, you know, a religious alim at that time to be learned. And this is really fascinating, that for an alim to be familiar with different languages. And we know that how much,
yes.
Linguistic knowledge can help, especially a mufassir or an alim in the field of Quranic studies, a person who wants to trace back the words, you know, into the original sources with their definitions and interpretations. This is very important. How many compilations does he have? I mean, writings. Allah Mustafavi.
Allah Mustafavi has about 70 different, you know, compilations that they are in different subjects and fields and majors. You know, because at that moment, at that time, you know, French was a dominant language in the world, and most of the people in Iran, they, you know, I mean, the educated people in Iran, they were learning French.
That's right.
And the result of learning Hebrew is that he wanted to study the Old Testament and the New Testament in the original language. So he learned Hebrew to get familiar with the, you know, original texts of Old Testament. And that's why we come to the his most outstanding work, that is At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Qur'an al-Kareem, that he, you know, dedicated most of his time in the ilm of lughat,
right,
that is, you know, trying to getting the exact meaning of the words, mm-hmm. especially about Quran.
That's right.
And because he, you know, knew different languages, he decided, for example, some, you know, words in Arabic are taken from different languages. When he comes to these words, especially from Hebrew, when he comes to these words in Quran, he, you know, gives the roots of the words.
Linguistically speaking, I think the Arabic and the Hebrew belong to the same family tree. So that's why some of the Arabic terms, you know, might be rooted back to the Hebrew root.
Yes.
That's why he knew Hebrew well, you know, an exegete of the Holy Quran. This makes him very special, okay?
Yeah. So when he's studying words as a linguist, so he tries to get the, you know, roots of words.
That's right.
That I think we need to talk about this book, At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Qur'an al-Karim, you know, in a special program because it's a unique work.
Yes.
So, but he is using, you know, this knowledge of learning languages to get more familiar with the meaning of the Holy Qur'an also.
Okay. Okay, Sheikh Mahd, have you any other details? Do we have about his scholarly life? As Sheikh Ziaynian said, At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Qur'an al-Karim needs a separate session. Also, Tafsir al-Roshan or Roshan exegesis of the Holy Quran. So, if any other details are not mentioned, please do that for us.
Okay. I think this is also very notable to be mentioned that when we talk about one scholar, most of the time we are talking of his scholarly aspect of his life.
Okay.
This is very important to know about Allama Hasan al-Mustafavi, that besides being a very knowledgeable scholar, he was really working on his spirituality, and he met a great asatid, and actually he had a good gathering as a teacher, or having these asatid as his friends.
Yes.
Among his asatid, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Qadhi is mentioned.
Okay.
Among the asatid from which he really benefited, and also Mirza Wadogha Ansari Hamedani, who is buried in Ali ibn Ja'far Cemetery in Qom.
Yes.
He is also one of the great asatid in the field of spirituality and mysticism and irfan.
Yes.
He had a very friendly gathering with him.
Yes.
And another name which is not that known to us is Mulla Aghajan Zanjani, who was really close to him with his friend, a group of 10 people. They had a weekly gathering with Mulla Aghajan Zanjani.
That's right.
And this is really important for such a distinguished personality, that besides his knowledge, he's working on his spirituality as well. And this is also narrated by his son, Dr. Sayyid Mustafa Mustafavi, if I'm not mistaken, that he was really staying away from the society in a way that he didn't want to become popular and become famous.
That's right.
So it was actually a noble fruit of working on his spirituality till end of his life, 2 years before he passed away, or 3 years, if I'm not mistaken. He accepted one official invitation from the Quranic exhibition, and
he participated and he gave an interview and he talked about his life and things okay. like this.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. Yes, you know, especially as you said, the presence of a spiritual tutor like Sayyid Ali Ghazi Tabatabai can also be very important in nurturing the character of Allama, and Allama Mustafavi was among the, I think, benefiters of the presence of these spiritual tutors like Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Ghazi Tabatabai. Okay, Sheikh Ziyani, anything?
Yes, regarding this, you know, aspect of his life, we should mention his book, Risale Liqa'ullah.
Mm-hmm.
That is a book regarding the
closeness to Allah, a treatise on how to get close to Allah.
How a servant can get close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and if any danger he may face with during this way, in this way. And also, he says that in this book, I have decided to just mention those points and, you know, issues that I'm completely and absolutely sure about them.
That's right.
So he's relying on riwayat and ayat in this book, and this book is very good those people who want to promote in this way.
Very good, very good. Really great work by Allama Mustafavi. You know, 19th day of Jamadil Awwal, 1426, is the day that this outstanding man passed away in the city of Tehran. He was taken to Bagh Behesh Cemetery in the holy city of Qom and is buried over there, and may he rest in peace, inshallah. We have to dedicate one separate session to At-Tahqiq fi Kalamat al-Qur'an al-Karim and his main research studies on the field of Quranic studies, something which is very much, I think, neglected in today's world, especially in the English language, how to be more familiar with the Shiite scholars who dedicated their life to the Islamic studies, especially the Holy Quran. But thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani, for this episode.
You're most welcome.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This was the teacher, I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information on this episode and to download for free our previous episodes of the teacher, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, fi amanallah, God bless you all.
Since the rise of Mohammed bin Salman as the Saudi crown prince, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has tried to offer a rather attractive face of itself through making a number of cosmetic changes. Allowing women to drive for the first time in the history of the kingdom, opening cinemas across the country after decades, and hosting international sporting events are all part of a greater scheme developed by the Saudis in a bid to rebrand their country as a land modern and safe enough for foreign investors. But every now and then, the kingdom rears its ugly head, showing its real colors. The tragic death of Professor Musa Al-Qarni in Dhahban prison once again reminds the international community of the kingdom's grave human rights record. Shortly after the death of Al-Qarni, the Saudi rights group Al-Quds tweeted, "Qarni was subjected to brutal torture, and the Saudi authorities deliberately harmed him by giving him unsuitable medication."
Fortunately, that's not a rarity at all. And, you know, to the contrary, for you know, dissenters to go against the KFA and end up dying in custody while undergoing such inhumane treatment and detention is actually something that happens very frequently. If they don't end up meeting their fate by other means, whether it's capital punishment or even, you know, being, as we all saw, assassinated while visiting a Saudi embassy in a foreign country. And, you know, we've seen in recent years frequently the way the regime has treated women's rights activists and other, you know, political prisoners.
This is just the latest example of slow killing of prisoners of conscience Riyadh has long been accused of. Blaming the Saudi authorities for violating the standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners, Sana'a organization has accused them of following the method of media concealment about the conditions of prisoners of conscience inside the cells of injustice to make their file more complex amid growing concern over their fate.
Oh, well, just earlier this year, there was another case of some Saudi humanitarian aid worker. I believe he worked for Red Crescent, who was sentenced to 20 years in prison and then another 20 years be forbidden to travel. Even if he survives his sentence and get out, he won't even be able to leave the country. And, you know, they tortured him by electrocuting him and flogging him until he signed, you know, a false confession admitting to the bogus charges. And that's just one of many examples. So, you know, cases like this are the rule, not the exception, where jailing of activists, you know, murder of dissidents, repression of women and journalists and anyone who peacefully dissents, that's the norm in Riyadh.
Musa Al-Gharni was born in 1954 in the Jazan region, Saudi Arabia. He obtained his PhD in jurisprudence at Umm Al-Qura University. In 2007, he was arrested and a few years later, in 2011, was sentenced to 15 years in prison, followed by a 20-year travel ban. Among the charges leveled against Al-Gharni were disobeying the king, planning to establish a party, communicating with foreign bodies, attempting to create chaos, and money laundering. Al-Gharni was a member of a group of rights activists who later came to be known as the Jeddah Reformers. The leader of the group, Saud al-Hashimi, received a 30-year prison sentence with a further 30-year travel ban, as well as a fine of 2 million riyals. Saudi Arabia is known across the world as one of the worst rights abusers, where rights advocates are detained and where peaceful activism is treated like an act of terrorism. Mohammed bin Salman's promises of reform soon turn out to be empty, while the macabre murder of Jamal Khashoggi put out the last faint flickers of hope.
We're talking about one of the most oppressive regimes in the world and biggest violators of human rights, not only against other countries like Yemen and Bahrain, but, you know, domestically against their own population. Most famously, as we've seen in the case of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, you know, even when dissidents have been living in self-imposed exile while working for, you know, a flagship Western newspaper, you know, they've made clear that speaking out against the royal family is not tolerated by the House of Saud, which will take, and they're willing to take any and all measures to silence those who would dare defy them.
Among other prominent reformists serving time are Sunni scholars such as Salman al-Ouda, Ali al-Omari, and Awad al-Gharni, not to mention Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, bin Salman's own uncle.
And, you know, it doesn't stop there. Even if you're somebody who's wealthy and powerful, you know, bin Salman placed his own cousin, for example, Princess Basma, if I'm saying that right, in prison, you know, just for the crime of advocating women's rights and criticizing the divorce laws. And, you know, she too was held in conditions where on social media, you know, there was posts that were deleted that said her health was deteriorating. So, if they don't outright assassinate you, they engage in slow motion assassination, like the case of this cleric where, you know, they detain political prisoners and keep them in conditions so dire and neglect their health. You know, if they don't outright execute you, you'll be killed in slow motion and held in such conditions where their health deteriorates.
By many credible accounts, the deceased academic was exposed to physical and psychological torture for 12 years, and following a deliberate health negligence, he suffered a brain stroke that resulted in his death. On October 19, Prisoners of Conscience tweeted, "Confirmed to us that the cause of Sheikh Musa al-Gharni's death was that he was beaten in the head and face by extremist prisoners as the prison administration placed him with them and refused to transfer him with the elderly." The Saudi authorities reportedly refused to hand over al-Gharni's body to his family, and he was buried in Al-Baghi in the absence of his family and friends. During his time in prison, al-Gharni was reportedly held incommunicado. His family was never allowed to visit him when he was behind bars.
You look at the creation of the Saudi state, which was essentially, you know, if you look at the way it was formed and the way that its territorial expansion occurred, which was to serve the interests ultimately as a proxy for British imperialism, and then that's continued with America's full spectrum dominance, the way the purpose that Saudi Arabia serves, I don't see any change in leadership coming to the kingdom. And as long as the House of Saud is in power, there's definitely not going to be anything other than these kind of really cosmetic reforms that are mainly, you know, to do things like open the country up to more foreign investment or increase tourism. There's certainly not going to be significant political reforms or any kind of transition to democracy as long as the House of Saud is in power, that's for sure.
To diversify its oil-based economy, the Saudi kingdom has formulated Vision 2030 and spent bags of money on PR exercises. But before anything else, the international community should urge the kingdom to take serious steps in improving human rights and lay it down as a precondition to any future financial interactions.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.